We believe in God, the Eternal Father.
We believe in the Bible to be the Word of God.
We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous.
We believe that through the atonement of Christ, all mankind.
We also believe the Book of Mormon to be the Word of God.
We may say that we follow the admonition of Paul. We believe all things. We hope all things. We have endured many things.
Welcome to Why I Believe. My name is Rick Starr. Long ago, President Ezra Taft Benson, then an apostle, stated, "We need to know more about the Jews, and the Jews ought to know more about Mormons." Mark Paredes has spent a great deal of his life immersed in the Jewish community. He has served as a United States diplomat in Israel, press attaché for the Consulate General of Israel in Los Angeles, Regional Executive Director for the Zionist Organization of America, National Outreach Director for the American Jewish Congress, and Speaker on Jewish Latter-day Saint Relations in the United States and across Europe. He currently writes a blog called Jews and Mormons for the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles, the most popular Jewish website outside of Israel. Now, Mark, welcome to the show, first of all. It's great to have you here with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here. I feel like I'm in the presence of a rock star here, so it's great.
Well, thank you. I feel the same about you. You once observed that you think you're the only biracial Mormon representing the state of Israel abroad. I thought that was pretty funny.
That was correct. Absolutely.
For two reasons. First of all, I'd love for you to explain the biracial Mormon part of that, and then also representing Israel abroad. Talk about that. What is your upbringing and how? What's your involvement in the Jewish community from your childhood?
Well, I'm from Michigan, and I have a black father, white mother, and I have a Chilean stepfather. So my last name is it's a Sephardic Jewish name, Paredes.
Oh, really?
He does have some Jewish blood in him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't observe anything related to Judaism, but he is of Jewish descent. Mm-hmm. And we sent my little brother to a Jewish nursery school. My father's boss was Jewish. I brought Holocaust survivors to my high school. I've had a long-standing relationship. I had an Israeli pen pal back in the days when you actually, instead of clicking send, you actually wrote out a letter and put a stamp on the envelope. So I have had a long, and when I lived in Moscow, I was the interpreter for the Time correspondent, Nancy Traver. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that all of the stories she covered were about Russian Jews. Hmm. So even before I was assigned to go to Israel as a U.S. diplomat, I had a strong relationship with the Jewish people. Hmm. And after serving as a U.S. diplomat in Israel, and it's amazing how that came about, I was in Mexico mm-hmm. serving my first tour. And since this is an LDS radio station, I can share this story. I received two very strong spiritual promptings one evening to study Hebrew. I just really felt prompted to study Hebrew. Mm. And the promptings were so strong that they caused me to call the Jewish school the next day and to ask for an Israeli tutor. Mm. And so I studied Hebrew for 6 months on my own, just believing that I had to study Hebrew. And then I got a cable from Washington, from the State Department, saying your next assignment is going to be Tel Aviv.
Wow.
So I lived in Israel for 2 years. Then I came to L.A., felt prompted to walk into the office of Keith Atkinson, who then was the public affairs director for the church in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I just felt, I had no idea who he was. I just felt prompted driving by to stop in, and I saw the sign that said public affairs office, stopped in. Mm. And he said, "It's funny you should walk in today because I just got off the phone with the Israeli consul general. And he's looking for a press attaché. Would you be interested in going to see him?" And during our interview, which he conducted in Hebrew, we talked about all kinds of subjects. And finally, he stopped the interview and he said, "Mark, if you can talk about camels in Mauritania in Hebrew, you can do this job." And he hired me. And he's since gone on to hire three more Latter-day Saint employees. He's currently the ambassador to Australia.
Oh, my goodness.
And so he hired me to represent the Israeli government. I had already represented the American government in Israel. Mm-hmm. And now I would be representing the Israeli government in 7 states in the United States.
Hmm. How long did you do that?
For 2 years.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing. So you've really been directed, it seems, to be involved in the Jewish and LDS relationship across the board as you've gone.
Well, you have to follow promptings. I don't claim to be a prophet or anyone like that, but I do think you have to follow promptings in life. Mm-hmm. And when you do, I think you get blessings.
Mm-hmm.
And you really gain experiences that you would not otherwise have gained.
Interesting. You served in Tel Aviv as a diplomat. What was your assignment there, and how was your religion a part of that?
Well, my assignment as a junior officer, it used to be, it no longer is the case, but it used to be that you had a rotation of assignments. So I served for 3 months as the ambassador's assistant. Mm-hmm. I served for 3 months as an economic officer. Then I was a political officer. And then I worked handing out visas in the consular section. So I had a variety of experiences. And I did a lot of reporting on the Druze community in Israel, and I did a lot of reporting on the Israeli Arab community. Every weekend I was traveling, and I went to many Palestinian areas because we worked also with the Palestinian government. I worked with the Israeli government. And my religion was a big plus in dealing with all of these communities. I'll give you one example of how much – you know, people don't realize, looking at the headlines coming from the Middle East sometimes, at how much tolerance there is in the area. When I first started visiting, my very first visit to Majd al-Shams, which is the largest Druze town, the Druze town on the Golan Heights, mm-hmm. they offered me tea. Mm-hmm. That's just what they do. They offered me tea and coffee, mostly coffee, actually. Mm-hmm. And I had to refuse, and I told them it was for religious reasons. So they brought me juice immediately. Mm-hmm. The next time I went back, I went to a different home in town, and I was served juice. Hmm. So I said to him, well, thank you so much. I said, I just have one question. Isn't it your custom to serve guests coffee? He said the head of the town, after I left the first time, had issued an edict stating that if I ever came to town again, I was to be offered juice. And when I took BYU students to visit this town, mm-hmm. we were always offered juice, no matter where we went. So there is a great deal of tolerance, religious tolerance in the region that I don't think makes the daily headlines.
Right. And that would be, when you're talking about tolerance, you're talking about between Palestinians and Jews and Christians, everybody who lives in that region.
Mm-hmm. I did see a great deal of tolerance. Mm-hmm. I really did. When you wander the old city of Jerusalem, sometimes you know, it's not easy to distinguish at first sight, unless the person's really religious, who's Jewish, who's Arab. Mm-hmm. People get on with their daily lives, and it's just mm-hmm. the extreme incidents that you read about, unfortunately.
Right. That's what we hear about in these far reaches. Yeah. I've been reading your blog that you've been writing for the Jewish Journal since May of 2010, and some amazing things there. Your initial entry in that blog I thought was very telling. You talked a lot about the relationship between Mormons and Jews, and I'm not sure that many Mormons will know what kind of relationship there is, both historically and currently and doctrinally. Could you touch a little bit on – let's start with historically – What role has the Restoration played in the gathering of Israel? And what does that mean to Jews and the relationship to Mormons? Talk a little bit about that. That's probably a two-hour discussion
seminar. How much time do we have here?
But if you could touch on that, just the highlights of that, because it's very interesting.
Well, I always say the first mention of a Jewish theme in LDS history came before the church was even established. Mm-hmm. Whenever I see the statue of the angel Moroni on a temple, and I'm in the company of a Jewish friend, I always say, this statue reminds me of Israel. And it's kind of, they say, well, why does that happen? What happened in September of 1823, three times in one night and one time the following day? Moroni appears to Joseph Smith. Mm-hmm. He'd been waiting hundreds and hundreds of years to talk to Joseph Smith. He had a lot to tell him. But one of the things that he repeated four times was a quotation from Isaiah chapter 11. It talks about the gathering of Israel. Mm-hmm. And so even before the church was established, there was a sort of a Jewish theme. Joseph Smith, of course, established the School of the Prophets. He had the leaders taught Hebrew. In the very first newspaper that was published by the church, Joseph Smith announced that this newspaper is brought to bring glad tidings to all peoples, but more especially to the house of Israel scattered abroad. I say that the first Zionist was Orson Hyde. Orson Hyde, in the April conference of 1840, announced that he was going to Palestine. Mm-hmm. And I think most people, if you were to ask most Mormons what the most important thing that he did, they would say it was the dedication of the land of Israel for the gathering of the Jewish people. I say that's the second most important thing that he did. What he did first was he went to Europe. And one of the things he did in Europe was to contact Jewish leaders there and to warn them to flee Europe for Palestine. He said that the devourer of the Gentiles was upon them, that if they didn't leave, that there would be calamities. And they didn't listen to him. Had they listened to Orson Hyde, world history and certainly Jewish history would have been very different.
Most definitely.
And then he went on to Israel to dedicate the land of Israel for the gathering of the Jewish people. He didn't go to convert anyone. That wasn't his mission. Mm-hmm. And he asked heaven to return the land to, quote, its rightful heirs. And then he left. And today, of course, there's a monument to Orson Hyde on Mount Scopus right by BYU's Jerusalem Center. Mm-hmm. And the church, even let's move fast forward ahead to the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. You know, the church maintains neutrality, and I think it's a very wise policy throughout the world on political disputes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the church were to immerse itself in all the world's political disputes, that's all our leaders would be doing all day is studying these things. So I think it's a very wise policy. But in 1948, President George Albert Smith publicly and privately assured Jewish leaders of the church's support for the fledgling state. And Israel bonds. Israel, like most other countries, issues bonds to fund infrastructure projects in Israel. Mm-hmm. Israel bonds were first issued in 1951, and the first church to purchase them was our church, the LDS Church, mm-hmm. 1952. President McKay not only bought $5,000 worth of bonds, but he on behalf of the church, but he issued a statement saying that this is done to show sympathy for the efforts of the Jewish people to establish themselves in their homeland. So, and the church has always maintained official contacts with the Israeli government to this day. In fact, when I worked at the consulate, the consul general would meet with a member of the First Presidency at least once a year. And he told me when he hired me, he said, you better behave yourself, or the next time I go to Salt Lake, I'm telling President Hinckley on you. So the church has a long history of involvement. And I will say that not only did the church support the establishment of the State of Israel, but it's the only country in the world whose independence was supported by the church.
That's amazing. You mentioned earlier when you were talking that Orson Hyde was the first Zionist. I think we ought to have a little discussion about what a Zionist is.
One of my favorite topics.
Yeah, if you could go into that, because you have an interesting story about something that happened to you in Norway when you mentioned this to somebody, that you were, what was your position?
I worked for the Zionist Organization of America at the time.
And you mentioned that to somebody, and it evoked quite a reaction, because I think in a lot of minds, modern-day minds, we understand Zionism to be somewhat associated with fundamentalism. But I think it would be a good lesson for us all if you would go into what is that. Tell the story, first of all, but then go into what is Zionism.
Actually. Well, I'll tell the story. Actually, let me tell one story as a lead-up to that story.
Okay.
Orson Hyde, as I said, was the first Zionist. A Zionist is a person who believes in establishing a Jewish state. I mean, there are Christian states in the world. There are Muslim states. Mm-hmm. And Israel is the only Jewish state. Quick story as to how this came about. Herzl, Theodor Herzl, was actually a Hungarian Jew who lived in Vienna. He was a journalist. And he was a secular Jew, not a religious Jew at all. He got a plum assignment as a journalist to be the cultural editor for his newspaper in Paris, which at the time was the cultural capital of the world. Mm-hmm. It just so happened that Theodor Herzl was in Paris, this is the late 1890s, when Dreyfus was being put on, during the Dreyfus trial. Dreyfus was a Jewish military officer who was accused of espionage. We know now that he was wrongly accused, but he was on trial. Mm-hmm. And to back up, Napoleon, many decades earlier, almost 100 years earlier, had met with what he called the Sanhedrin, all of the Jewish leaders of France. Mm-hmm. And he asked them a question. He said, are you a religion or are you a nation? If you're a religion, we can absorb you into French society. You'll be just like every other Frenchman. If you're a nation, we will never accept you as Frenchmen. Rabbis, being very intelligent people, came back to him and said, we're a religion. Mm-hmm. So they made a pact with Napoleon, with the French government, that they would be Frenchmen. Fast forward 80 years later, Herzl goes to the trial of Dreyfus. Outside, he hears crowds screaming, not death to Dreyfus, not death to traitors, but death to Jews. Mm. He says, we have to get out of here. So I call Theodor Herzl the second Orson Hyde. He was the founder of the Zionist movement, and he kept telling Jews in Europe to leave. Mm-hmm. They didn't listen to him, just like they didn't listen to Orson Hyde. So a Zionist is only that. It's only a person who believes that there should be a Jewish state. If you read the writings of Herzl, he imagined, he says, a synagogue next to a mosque, next to a Buddhist temple. He was not at all about exclusivity. Other people were welcome to live in the Jewish state, mm-hmm. just like today. There are about 1.3 million non-Jewish citizens of Israel. Mm-hmm. I think when people think of Zionism, they think of, you know, Jews excluding everyone and attacking other people and not making them welcome. That wasn't at all what Zionism is. So the story that you alluded to, when I was in Norway, I was speaking in Norway recently, and I was on the main drag at a restaurant in Oslo, and three beautiful young girls came in and asked if they could sit with me. Now, being a bachelor and, you know,
of course,
not being as dumb as I look, I said, please join me. And we started talking, and of course, we asked each other what we did for a living. Mm-hmm. And when I told them I worked for a Jewish organization, they said, well, which one? I said, the Zionist Organization of America. One of them physically moved her chair back a few inches. She said, you're a Zionist. It's like I told her I strangled puppies for a living. And I said, you know, yes, I'm a Zionist. She said, well, how can you be a Zionist? I said, well, do you know what a Zionist is? And she stopped for a second. She said, no, but I know it's bad. So we spent a half hour talking about Zionism. And I convinced two of them that they were actually Zionists. The third one was still not sure. But I think that that's all that Zionism is. Zionism does not mean being anti-Arab, anti-Muslim. It only means that you feel that after all the persecution they've endured, that the Jews should have a state, a place where they're safe. And that's all a Zionist is.
Mm. Well, thank you for that explanation. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Why I Believe on the Mormon Channel. And today our guest is Mark Paredes, who writes a blog for the Jewish Journal in L.A. Incidentally, one of the biggest publication outside of Israel as far as an internet publication for the Jewish community. And please, you can download this program and other programs on the Mormon Channel by going to radio.lds.org. I'm sure you'll want to listen to this one again and again because there's a great deal of knowledge here that Mark is sharing with us. Mark, you alluded to some of the suffering that the Jews went through. They were persecuted beginning in the 1800s in Europe. And, of course, it went on from there. Ezra Taft Benson later referred to Mormons and Jews as kin, sort of, as brothers, because of our co-suffering. And talk a little bit about that and how that has helped you in your outreach to Jews in explaining Mormonism to them.
It's interesting. I start from a position that I don't think anyone else has ever taken. The Council of Nicaea was a very famous council called by Constantine, the Roman Emperor, in the 4th century A.D. After visiting Auschwitz not long ago, I of course, was my mind reflected on why something like that had to happen. And I was drawn to section 123 of the Doctrine and Covenants, where it says that the same spirit that influenced the creeds of the fathers had led to the suffering of the Latter-day Saints. So I reflected on the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea is famous for two things. Number one, it instituted state-sponsored discrimination against Jews. State-sponsored anti-Semitism began at the Council of Nicaea. The anti-Semitic bishops there called the Jews odious, detestable, and hateful.
Really? I would guess not many people know that or have heard of that.
In the Jewish community, some people know. In the Christian community, most people don't. Mm-hmm. Because what else is the Council famous for? The doctrine of the Trinity.
Yeah.
So for Mormons and Jews, and to non-Mormons and Jews listening to this, I mean no offense, but to Mormons and Jews, the beginning of official persecution of Jews, state persecution of Jews, began when people started worshiping a God that does not exist. It's very interesting. Mm. So when you look at the people who are persecuting Mormons in modern times, I have to agree with one of the leaders of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. In Utah especially, I know people will remember this, not too long ago, a few years ago, there was an anti-Mormon organization that distributed anti-Mormon DVDs throughout Utah, and I know they hit Arizona and even California. Mm-hmm. The only non-Mormon official that I was aware of who spoke out against this was the director of the ADL in Phoenix. Hmm. We didn't have any contact with him. He just spoke out and said, this is outrageous. So I called him to thank him. I said, but why is it that you felt the need to do this? He said, Mark, they can't fool me. He said, the anti-Semites of yesterday, in most cases, are the anti-Mormons of today. Hmm. And I think in many cases, he's right. You know, I'm often asked by Jews, one issue that they care about with Christians is, you know, do you believe that the Jews killed Jesus? Well, the New Testament specifies that there were a few Jewish leaders who were involved, but Mormons, it's safe to say, are generally not taught that the Jews as a people are responsible for the sins of those people. We're taught that people are punished for their own sins, not for Adam's transgression. And so they'll ask me specifically about the blood curse found in Matthew, where the crowd gathers, asks for Jesus to be killed, and then when Pilate says, I don't find any sin in this man, they say, well, let his blood be upon us and upon our children. That verse is probably the bloodiest verse of the New Testament. It's probably led to the spilling of more Jewish blood throughout the centuries than any other. So when I'm asked about that, I always say that there's no reason, according to our theology, why God has to be bound by something that a mob says. So I think that Mormons don't have a history of anti-Semitism. We have a history of rejecting a lot of the same things that the Jews do. And it's so interesting, too, because I think that Christians throughout the centuries have condemned Jews for not accepting Christianity. When Joseph Smith prayed in 1820 to know what the true church was, which church was he told to join? He was told to join none of them. So Mormons do not fault Jews throughout the centuries for not joining what we would consider to be apostate Christianity. So we also look at Judaism from a completely different perspective. Most Christians, if you ask them, will use a tree analogy. They'll say Judaism is the roots and Christianity is maybe the trunk or the branches or the fruits or whatever. Mormons, we look at them, we're the only Christian church that does not believe that Judaism predates it. The first Mormon was Adam. In our theology. So if you use the tree analogy, we have to use sort of the ring circles. You know, you have Adam as the core, maybe Enoch and Noah, Abraham. And then from Moses to Jesus, you had these rings. Judaism was part of the gospel during that time. So we look at Judaism from a completely different perspective. And a lot of the same people who've persecuted them in modern times are persecuting us. And I believe it's because the House of Israel has a bullseye on it and has from the beginning. I honestly believe that, you know, one of the questions that no one can answer is why the Holocaust had to happen. When Latter-day Saints look at why the Holocaust happened, it's interesting that, you know, I firmly believe, this is my opinion, that Satan has had us in his crosshairs, you know, since time began. Because for Latter-day Saints, even though for Jews the concept of a covenant people begins at Sinai with Moses, for Latter-day Saints, it's an eternal concept. It begins in the preexistence, ends in the eternities. So because he had us in his crosshairs, I firmly believe that he wanted to wipe out as many members of the House of Israel as he could to prevent the establishment of Israel. Fortunately, he can't see into the future. So his actions actually caused what he wanted to prevent. And so persecution has been a common theme in both of our histories. I don't think we can compare our persecution to the Jews, quite frankly, but we have been persecuted as a people. And yes, that is something that I share with Jews on occasion, and I think that it resonates with a lot of them.
That's good. You know, I've noticed that as I've read your blog, that you focus a great deal on the commonalities between Mormons and Jews, one of them being the co-suffering, the extermination orders given on both of the groups. I've also noticed as I've read your blog that you've been very bold about what Mormon doctrine is. And this is written in a Jewish publication. I'm wondering what type of response do you get from the Jewish community about the Mormon doctrine that you share with them?
It's interesting. First of all, let me point out something that I'm very proud of. I did not ask to do this blog. The managing editor called me and he asked me to do it in May.
So a great deal of trust in you.
I had known him for years. That's true. But I asked him why. Because you don't have a Mormon evangelical blog. You don't have a Mormon Presbyterian blog. You don't have a Mormon, Buddhist blog.
Right.
Or I'm sorry, Jewish Buddhist blog. Why Mormons? He said, I just feel there's something there. He said, I feel that your community has more to tell us than other communities. And my blog, luckily, has had enough response that the Jewish newspaper in San Francisco recently started a Jewish Mormon blog there.
Really?
It's written by my colleague Krista Woodall, and it's the name of the publication is J Weekly. It's available online. So more and more people are feeling this. But in answer to your question about how Jews feel about the Mormon doctrine that I present, first of all, I don't do so in a proselytizing way. I think that would be very offensive. But several Jews have written to say, I'm glad that you are writing these things because when I log on to a Jewish Mormon blog, I want to get the Mormon word. I don't want to find a Mormon who's not in tune, not in harmony with his church's positions. For instance, there was even one gay Jew who wrote in, because I did blog once on gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, when I blogged in, I didn't know whether I'd get, you know, I really blogged in logged onto your blog to find out what the Mormon position was. He said, and I'm glad that I got an Orthodox Mormon position. He said, I don't agree with it. But he said, I think it's important that you present the Orthodox Mormon position. Because mm-hmm. I think that when people log on to a Jewish Mormon blog, that's what they want. They don't want a Mormon who's out there, you know, as far as doctrine goes. They want to find out what Mormons think, what mm-hmm. Orthodox Mormons think about a given issue.
Mm, very good. You're listening to Why I Believe on the Mormon Channel. My name is Rick Starr, and our guest today is Mark Paredes, who has had a great deal of involvement in the Jewish community from his childhood and currently writes a blog for the Jewish Journal in Los Angeles. Mark, in the blog that we've been talking about, I read one of the blogs a few months ago that you wrote somewhat rebuking a Jewish rabbi in a Jewish publication. And I thought that was interesting. I tried to turn it around in my mind and imagine a Jewish rabbi rebuking a Mormon bishop or stake president in an editorial in the Mormon Times or something like that, which is not – that's not an official church publication, but nevertheless, it is a publication that talks about Mormon issues. And so I wondered what was the reaction. First of all, give us a little background to this, because I know you have a great deal of respect for this rabbi who you somewhat rebuked. but talk a little bit about that relationship and what happened there.
Well, thank you. Well, first of all, the rabbi is Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, who I know is well known in Utah, and he's probably the country's most famous Orthodox rabbi. Mm-hmm. He, in fact, once said that Christians are our kin, but Mormons are our brothers. So he has a great deal of respect for the Latter-day Saint community. Mm-hmm. So he has written a book. And I also must point out that disagreement is actually encouraged in the Jewish community so long as you do it respectfully. Mm. So, you know, it's the famous saying is that there are two Jews and three opinions. You know? So Jews love to disagree as long as they do so respectfully. So I'm sure that Rabbi Shmuley did not take it personally. It was not meant for him to be taken personally. But he is his book is about to come out claiming that basically the New Testament does not claim that Jesus was the Savior, that he was just an observant Jew, and that
that he was a Pharisee, basically.
That he was a Pharisee.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's incorrect on many points. I mean, obviously, Jesus rebuked the Pharisees, even though the Pharisees, I do think, sometimes get a bum rap from history. But Jesus clearly was not a Pharisee. Mm-hmm. He clearly was the Son of God. He was the Savior. And the New Testament says this on many occasions. And I thought it was inappropriate, frankly, for a rabbi to be telling Mormons or telling Christians what they should believe about Jesus. Mm-hmm. I think that when you engage in interfaith dialogue, there are some lines that you can't cross. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of them. You really have to tread lightly if you're going to presume to tell Christians what they should believe. I think that people have a right to believe, to define their own beliefs. And, you know, we've seen this on many occasions. Christians, of course, some Christians telling Mormons that they actually don't believe what we claim to believe.
Right.
It's always offensive to hear that. Mm-hmm. So I think for a rabbi to write a book telling Christians that basically they don't know how to interpret the New Testament was inappropriate. And it reminds me that there are some conversations, interestingly enough, that Mormons and Jews can't have. I think we can have conversations, and I'll get to that in just a second, with Jews that other Christians can't have, but there's some that we can't have with Jews. For instance, along these same lines, we'll talk about the Old Testament now, there is a rabbi in Los Angeles who prides himself on sitting down with Christians and convincing them that the scriptures that they generally claim refer to Jesus in the Old Testament mm-hmm. don't refer to Jesus.
In Isaiah and so forth.
In Isaiah. Mm-hmm. And he said, Mark, you read Hebrew, so I'm going to show you that the scriptures that you claim, you know, where Isaiah speaks messianically, etc., don't refer to Jesus at all. Mm. I said, Rabbi, I'd be happy to sit down with you. I'd like to learn from you. I'd love to learn what your interpretation of these words is, but let me tell you right off the bat, I think it'd be a waste of your time. Because I will stipulate from the beginning that everything you say about the Old Testament is true. I'll rip it up. We can just dispense with the Old Testament, and then I'll present you with the Book of Mormon and have you take Jesus out of the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price.
An impossibility.
So it doesn't really matter whether this word means this or this in the Old Testament. That's not the basis of my faith. I mean, I do believe that Isaiah speaks messianically. I certainly do believe that. But even if you can convince me that that's not true, that doesn't shake my faith at all. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are conversations that we can't have with Jews There are conversations that we can have that other people can't. And I'll give you an example. Not too long ago, I invited a pastor, a wonderful pastor, who's fond of Mormons and Jews, to my interfaith class to lecture on evangelicalism. Fascinating mm-hmm. presentation. At the end, there was a student who raised her hand, and she said, "Pastor, let me ask you a few questions. What's God doing for the Jews right now, for Judah?" Mm-hmm. Pastor got it half right, in my opinion. He said he's gathering them to Israel. Well, he's also gathering them to the Americas. There are as many Jews in the United States as there are in Israel. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting for Latter-day Saints because Israel is the land of Judah and the Americas are the land of Joseph or Ephraim.
Right.
So I've always viewed that as being very interesting. So he will give him full credit because he's not aware of that. So he said he's gathering Judah to Israel. She said, "What's the birthright tribe in Israel?" He got it right. He said Ephraim. Mm-hmm. What's her next question? She says, "What's God doing for the birthright tribe?" I don't know. I have no idea. Well, Mormons do know. Uh-huh. And so we can talk about the gathering in that way, how God is gathering Judah to the United States and Israel. And since this is an official channel, let me just point out that the gathering to the United States is sort of my view of things. And, you know, the church officially believes this gathering to Israel. But I also believe that Jews have been gathered to America for a while. And he's also gathering the other tribes through the church. And so we can talk about this with Jews. They usually find it fascinating whether or not they agree with us. And I will say one other thing on this topic. You know, Mormons are really into which tribe they belong to. Mm-hmm. You know, it often happens that a Mormon will go to a Jewish friend and say, "I'm from the tribe of Ephraim." And the Jewish friend will shrug his shoulders and say, "Well, you know, the tribal identity is not really a part of modern Jewish life unless you happen to be a Kohen, one of the priestly, a member of the priestly caste." Mm-hmm. And one of the most common questions I get from Mormons anyway, is how can I convince my Jewish friend that I'm really a member of the House of Israel? I give them the advice that I was given when I first started out in the Jewish community by a very wise Jewish man. He said, "Mark, whether I believe you're a member of the tribe of Israel or not, doesn't really matter. Hmm. What matters is that you believe you're a member of the House of Israel. Because if you believe it, and you act on your belief, and you show Jews that you love them because you consider them fellow members of the House of Israel, mm-hmm. no Jew is going to fault you for that." Mm. So it's not important that I believe, it's important that you believe it. And I believe that that's true.
Mm. And that leads to an interesting discussion because our Bible dictionary talks about what is the House of Israel. And a lot of times, and I think many Jewish members believe this, and probably many of our faith also have this idea that a Jew is the house of Israel, or the Jewish nation is the house of Israel. If you read the Bible dictionary, it talks about what a Jew is, and you can expound on this a little bit. But what our Bible dictionary says is that Jews can be either descendants of Judah, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, or people of the ancient southern kingdom of Judah, or people who practice the religions, lifestyles, and traditions of Judaism, even though they may not be Jewish by birth. It has become customary to use the word Jew to refer to all descendants of Jacob, but this is a mistake. It should be limited to those of the kingdom of Judah. So the kingdom of Israel is actually much bigger than just the tribe of Judah, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Can you expound on that a little bit?
That's an excellent point. I think that when you refer to Jews as – I think that the Jews have been – sort of synonymous with the House of Israel because throughout the centuries they've remained the only identifiable group of mm-hmm. Israelites. The mm-hmm. others were scattered and, you know, to parts unknown until the church was reestablished. So I think that's why Jews, in their defense, you know, consider themselves sort of synonymous with the House of Israel because to them they have maintained the traditions of the ancient House of Israel and they've been the only identifiable group of Israelites and they have been persecuted as a result. So I think they do have a right to because of their persecution, to sort of assume a special status for themselves, at least until these modern Israelites called Mormons appeared on the scene. But I think it's true. I mean, when the Romans came in AD 70 and destroyed the temple and then scattered everyone living in that area to parts unknown, there were people – Jerusalem was a very cosmopolitan city. So there were people living in Jerusalem who were from all over Israel, from all the tribes. So when they were scattered – even though they may have, as the Bible dictionary says, maintained the culture of the house of the tribe of Judah, of Judaism, mm-hmm. they may not have been blood Judahites. Mm-hmm. So it would be as if Utahns were suddenly transplanted halfway across the world, or to parts unknown, and they were known as Utahns. Even though many people in Utah came from all 50 states and many countries, mm-hmm. they would be known as the Utahns. So the people living in the land of Israel at the time the Romans kicked them all out and dispersed them were not necessarily all from the house of Judah. In the tribe of Judah. They were from various tribes, but they became known as Jews because they did band together. They tried to form communities, did the best they could to retain their customs and traditions and beliefs throughout the centuries. But no, in no sense can Jews be considered synonymous with the whole house of Israel. Mm-hmm. It's just that until the church was restored, and through the power of the priesthood, we couldn't find the other Israelites. We didn't know where they were.
Right. Well, you actually mentioned to some of your Jewish friends that Latter-day Saints are actually Latter-day members of the House of Israel. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I had a question for you that might be a little interesting, but I was wondering if, from your point of view, being so deeply immersed in the Jewish community, what would one thing... If there was one thing that you wished Mormons knew about Jews more than they do, what would that be? And likewise, if there was one thing that you wish Jews knew more about Mormons, what would that be?
I think if there was one thing I would want Mormons to know about Jews, it's that they are probably the best coalition builders in the world. And what I mean by that is there's a recent study that came out by a Mormon professor and a Jewish professor in a book that just came out. And they mentioned that Mormons are probably the most accepting of others' beliefs, but they're one of the three least popular members, least popular religious groups in America. Mm-hmm. Jews are great coalition builders. They have to be. They've historically been an oppressed minority, so they've built coalitions. And Jews are now, believe it or not, this shocks many Jews now. It certainly would have shocked them 20, 30, 50 years ago. They're the most popular religious group in America. So what does that mean? That means that Jews are very willing to collaborate with Mormons on almost any project that does not involve theology or strictly church affairs. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why Jewish women shouldn't be participating in Relief Society enrichment projects. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why they shouldn't collaborate on Mormon Helping Hands projects. Jews are very, very willing to work with Mormons, and I just think they need to be invited more. Latter-day Saints sometimes, like all religious communities, we can become insular sometimes. Mm-hmm. If there's a Mormon event, we invite Mormons. We invite all the wards. We send out an email to the bishops and the stake presidents, make sure that they're invited. Do we send out emails to the rabbis, the imams, to the other religious leaders, letting them know mm-hmm. that they can participate in this activity
That's
as well.
Point.
So I think that the one thing I think that I wish that Mormons knew is that Jews are very willing to collaborate with them, particularly in service mm-hmm. to others. That's a very important theme in Judaism. And if there's one thing I wish that Jews knew about Mormons, it's that most Mormons I know genuinely want to befriend Jews. There's no hidden agenda. It's not to get them into the baptismal font. That Mormons genuinely feel a closeness to Jews that sometimes can't be rationally explained. I mean, they just feel mm-hmm. closeness to Jews, a great love for them, and they want to embrace them. And it doesn't mean that they want to present them with the Book of Mormon with their name engraved on it. They just genuinely want to reach out to them. And sometimes they don't know how to. And, mm-hmm. and so that's where the interfaith outreach comes in.
Mm. Well, you're certainly doing a great work there. It's amazing.
It's keeps me busy, and the Jewish community is a very interesting one. It's a very dynamic, energetic community.
Mm-hmm. I noticed as I read your blog that I had a feeling, even though you were quite bold in talking about Mormon doctrine or about Jewish-Mormon relations, I didn't feel there was anything of offense to be taken. I felt it was a very unifying experience for me, and I actually came away from it wanting to know more about my Jewish brothers and sisters and how I could become their friends, just like you were talking about.
Well, then I've succeeded, at least with one reader. That's great. I mean, that is the goal. I don't really have a hidden agenda in writing this. It's simply to explain Mormons to Jews, explain Jews to Mormons, and where the two can meet. That nothing makes me happier than to see Mormons and Jews together.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. I was speaking in Montreal last year, and with an Orthodox rabbi, we did a dialogue in Montreal for the first time that they had a dialogue like that.
Mm.
And the Orthodox rabbi got up, and he said, I'm going to do something I've never done before. Would you mind if I sang for you? And he started a song called Hine Matov. I'll explain the lyrics in just a second. And the temple president in Montreal happens to have been a director of the BYU Center in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. He immediately got up, they locked arms, and they sang Hine Matov, which means this is what is Hine Matov Umanaim. This is what is good and wonderful to see brothers sitting together. Mm. Very moving moment. Mm. And the Orthodox rabbi was very touched, and they have had follow-up events in Montreal as a result. So I think that when people make the decision to reach out, you know, it's richly rewarding to all faith groups, not just Jews.
Yeah, that's very neat. You're listening to Why I Believe on the Mormon Channel. I'm Rick Starr, and today my guest is Mark Paredes, who has been deeply involved in the Jewish community and currently writes a blog for the Jewish Journal in Los Angeles. Incidentally, you can download this and other programs on the Mormon Channel by going to radio.lds.org and listen to them at your convenience, and we encourage you to do that. Mark, I wonder if you've ever had a dialogue with a Jewish leader in the sense where you're talking about the Book of Mormon. There's many references to Jews in the Book of Mormon. In fact, in the title page, it says that this is a book that is written for Jew and Gentile, and that it is expressly written for the purpose of convincing the Jew and the Gentile about Jesus Christ. What types of discussions have you had about the Book of Mormon with Jewish leaders?
Well, in private, we've had many discussions. In a public dialogue, we haven't really touched much on the Book of Mormon, although in St. Louis last year, I did talk about the Pearl of Great Price in order to show why we have a Pearl of Great Price, in order to clarify some things. For instance, it's not clear in Genesis why Cain really decided to kill Abel. Mm-hmm. The Pearl of Great Price expands on that. It's not clear why Lamech later on, it says nothing about his motivation for killing someone. And I think so I use that as an example to show why we have additional scriptures. Mm. The Book of Mormon, in private, many Jewish leaders have read it. Mm. Many rabbis have the Book of Mormon in their private libraries. Not all of them, but many of them do. And some of them, when I visited them, have pulled it out and asked me to explain. I remember one of them wanted me to explain the allegory, the olive tree allegory found in Jacob. He found that particularly interesting. Mm. And others want to know what the Jewish theme is throughout the book, you know, what Jewish themes are there, you know, and I explained that they kept the law of Moses, they built temples, that Lehi was of the tribe of Manasseh, they came from Jerusalem, and they find that interesting. Do they believe the book? You know, probably not. But many of them are interested because they do sense a Jewish-Mormon connection somewhere. Mm-hmm. We brought five rabbis to Salt Lake City not too long ago, and we did a tour. They met with some church leaders, and we took them on an open house tour of the Draper Temple. And Elder Walker of the 70, who's the president of the temple, the head of the temple department, took us on a tour. He was very gracious to do that. It was remarkable to see the effect on those rabbis. There was one rabbi, the most orthodox of them, wore a kippah or a yarmulke, a head covering, all mm-hmm. the time. And when we entered the celestial room, he took off his kippah. Mm-hmm. He just stood up, looking up at the ceiling. When we left the celestial room, he put it back on. And I said, Rabbi, I have to ask, you know, why did you take off your kippah? He said, this is the most holy place I've ever been in. Hmm. He said, I felt I had to show respect. And he sent us a letter afterwards saying that in 50 years of interfaith work, he'd never experienced anything like that. He said it was a religious experience. He said, I've come back from this tour convinced that there is a Jewish-Mormon connection. Hmm. So I think that when you explore LDS themes or Jewish themes in the Book of Mormon, that Jews at least want to understand why Mormons feel this connection to them. And I think that if they give the Book of Mormon a chance and at least read parts of it, they will see why.
You know, it's interesting as you look at some of the links that we feel that might not be found in other Christian faiths. Temples, for one. Prophets, which the Jewish, you know, it's throughout the Jewish history.
The second coming of Elijah. Don't forget that one.
Mm-hmm.
and you mentioned temples. Let me go off on temples for 1 second. Temples are, I always tell my Jewish friends and my Mormon friends that they're so powerful that everyone in the world has access to some of their power. And what do I mean by that? You know, what service does the temple provide to everybody? Mm-hmm. Well, and most recently I had an Orthodox rabbi whose son was diagnosed with a severe brain problem. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, Rabbi, what I can do is put your son's name on the prayer roll. And I explained to him what it was, half expecting him to say, you know, thank you very much, but no thanks. He said, not only do I want you to put my son's name on the prayer roll, but I want you to keep his name on the prayer roll. And I've actually never had a Jewish friend turn down an offer to put someone's name on the prayer roll. So I think that temples, you know, they have a special power, and I think that sometimes we act like they're only for Latter-day Saints. Mm-hmm. They're for everyone in the world. There's some ordinances that only Latter-day Saints can perform in them. That's true. But temples are for everyone, and I think our Jewish friends, we can help them avail themselves of some of the power in the temple.
Wonderful. You've mentioned, I'm not sure if it was in your blog or in another discussion, you talked about converted Jews becoming more complete Jews. Talk a little bit about that.
Let me clarify that those were not my words. Those were the words of the LDS converts, the Jewish converts to the
oh,
church.
I see. Okay.
Let me clarify that because I want to make sure. That's what they often claim. And in fact, a lot of Jewish converts to Christian faiths claim that they're more complete Jews.
I see.
You know, it's interesting. This is a discussion that's a very sensitive one, and it's one that I stay out of because two very important principles clash. I mean, I think that people have a right to define themselves. If I'm a Jew and I convert to the church and I still consider myself to be Jewish, well, mm-hmm. I have a right to do that. However, groups also have the right to exclude people. And, you know, if the Jews say, well, once you accept Jesus, you can no longer be a Jew, you know, I have to respect both rights here. So I generally stay out of that discussion. And it even becomes an issue when I'm asked, as I often am, to participate in the conversion process of a Jew to the church. Mm-hmm. So I've drawn up some guidelines. You know, I don't go out with the missionaries if they're going to Jewish neighborhoods. I don't think that's appropriate. And I also don't actually meet with the Jewish investigator. I will give the missionaries information if they want mm-hmm. a copy of that list of commonalities, but I don't feel comfortable sitting down with them.
And when you say it's not appropriate, it's not that it's not appropriate for missionaries to be teaching Jews. It's that you don't feel that it's appropriate for you to be included in that, given your place
exactly.
in the Jewish community.
Thank you for that. Yes, no, yeah. It's perfectly appropriate. Missionaries can teach everyone. Mm-hmm. They don't target Jews. They don't target people of any particular faith, but they do. It's certainly appropriate for them to be teaching anyone who wants to mm-hmm. investigate the church.
Sure.
I just think of what would happen if I were door knocking with them and I knocked on the door of a prominent rabbi who knew me. I mean, that would be a very, very unpleasant situation.
Right.
So, but I will go to baptisms. I have gone to a few baptisms of Jews. Once they've made the commitment to join the church, then, you know, and I certainly help to fellowship them. Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, it's a fine line there sometimes.
Right.
And you just have to draw boundaries.
Yeah. Well, you've certainly given a unique perspective of the Jewish community to Mormons. Well, and I think you've encouraged us all that we might go out and invite any of our Jewish brothers and sisters to any of our events. And it seems like that would be reciprocated, very much so.
Absolutely. You know, whenever I meet Mormons who say they love Jews, my first question is, which Jewish organization do you belong to? You know, we are very lucky when we're dealing with the Jewish community because I know that the church is very careful, and I think rightly so, to, you know, the church is a little cautious sometimes about just sending members out to build bridges to people, and especially organized groups, because it doesn't want to give the impression that these people are formal representatives of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Jewish people, you know, they're not a hierarchical faith group. There's no Jew in the world who can speak on behalf of all Jews. So if they see a Mormon going to a Jewish event, they will never, ever assume that this person's an official representative of the church. Mm-hmm. They'll just assume that he's a Mormon who wants to do what they want to do. I'll give you a perfect example. Last year, there's a group called JINSA. They advocate closer military cooperation between the United States and Israel. Mm-hmm. It's probably not an organization the church will ever formally collaborate with. But there was an Army Ranger in my ward who just returned from Afghanistan. I said, he needs to come because they had invited a Pentagon general to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Not only was he warmly received, they had him lead the Pledge of Allegiance. The general spoke. He told him which battalion he was with. The general talked about how he had visited them in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And they made him an honorary member of JINSA. And to my knowledge, he's still going to their meetings. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not an official representative of the church. But I think that, you know, there's a Jewish organization for every interest, believe me. I mean, the church is, because we have a lay clergy, we just don't have a lot of time to form these organizations. But the Jews do, and, you know, there are thousands of Jewish organizations. So if you really feel close to the Jewish people, I can guarantee you there's an organization for you to join.
And they would welcome you.
And they would welcome you, absolutely.
That's wonderful. Hmm? That's wonderful. Well, Mark, we've talked about a lot of experiences that you've had with the Jewish community, Jewish leaders as a Mormon, and it's great to hear that there are so many other Mormons, at least in your area, many of your associates, who are getting involved in bridge building with the Jewish community. That's wonderful to hear. What do you see as some of the future issues that might be attached to the Jewish-Mormon relationship and to each of us individually as a faith?
Well, one thing I can say is that this is happening throughout the world, all across the country, in Canada and in Europe. I remember I spoke in Sweden not too long ago, and there was a dynamic German couple. They were institute directors. They said, "We have to do something." Next thing I know, they had rounded up the missionaries, the institute students, and they were working with the Jews to maintain Jewish cemeteries in southern Sweden. I mean, there are lots of pioneers, incredible. The Radas. I want to get their name on the radio. The Radas are a celestial couple. And there's a lot of collaboration going on in Europe. The missionaries have maintained Jewish cemeteries in Poland, for example. Mm-hmm. And there's a great deal of interest in Europe among Latter-day Saints in reaching out to Jews who don't have the easiest time right now in Europe. So I think it's a worldwide phenomenon. And I think that as the gathering of Israel proceeds through the church, I think that you're going to see more and more people reaching out to Jews and vice versa. I think the Jews are going to feel increasingly comfortable with Mormons. I think that on a very small scale, we have two major Jewish newspapers with Mormon bloggers. You know, 5 years from now, we may have every major Jewish newspaper with a mm-hmm. with a website with bloggers. I think the BYU Center is a wonderful asset in the Holy Land. People return from there with a great deal of love for the peoples of the region. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very optimistic about the future of Jewish LDS collaboration as the House of Israel is gathered throughout the world, whether it's to Judah and Joseph, the land of Joseph, or through LDS chapels throughout the world.
Wonderful. Well, we just have a few minutes left, Mark, and it's been great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for your viewpoint. So many interesting experiences. Why don't we end with you sharing your testimony in general and specifically in relation to your involvement with the Jewish community?
Well, I converted at age 11, and I have to say that the church has been the major blessing in my life. I know without a doubt that this is the work of God. This is the eternal work of God. This is the work that's been going on since before this world was created and will go on long after we are gone. And I do have a testimony that God lives, and I know for a fact that we do live after we die, and that we will know everything after we die, but I do know that we will live after we die, and that we will find out that the work that we've been doing through the church will have had eternal consequences. I do have a testimony that I have been directed to work with the Jews. I don't know how much longer that will last, but I do have a testimony that I was inspired to reach out to the Jews, and they have been inspired, I believe, to reach out to Mormons. And I have a great testimony that they are members of the House of Israel. They're entitled to all the blessings of the House of Israel, and someday they will get them. And I have a testimony that Jesus is the Christ, that he was a Jew, and that he is the Savior of everyone. And I'm just enormously grateful for the work that the church is doing to promote the gathering of the House of Israel. And I'm grateful for our temples. I mean, the center of temple worship is the Abrahamic Covenant. And what a great blessing that is. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity to share this with your listeners, Rick. And I want to every reader, every listener to know that I know that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the Church of God on earth. That Jesus Christ is our Savior, that he leads and guides and directs this church.
Mark, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rick.
Appreciate you being our guest on our program.
Thank you.
Mark Paredes is a blogger for the Jewish Journal in L.A., a former diplomat and a long time being involved with the Jewish community. Thank you again, Mark, for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure, Rick.
You've been listening to Why I Believe on the Mormon Channel. For more information on this program and other programs on the Mormon Channel, please go to radio.lds.org. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great day.